So, what was the phrase again?
Sonas pronto.
You are listening to the Frilla Bros Tech Podcast, episode 277, The Foresight to Develop Gaming Platforms.
Season 7, episode 277 of the Frilla Bros Tech Podcast. Today is January the 15th, 2017. I'm Matthew Dean Frilla, and charging from San Diego to LA is my brother James Frilla.
Yeah, what's up with LA? It's like they've figured out, like, oh, football. It's you go to LA to die, apparently. Is that how that's all going to work? Thinking about it, all the games are televised. They're better to watch on TV than in real life anyway, so who cares where the team's located?
Yeah, you say that, except I get this weird feeling that, you know, obviously this is we're all looking at this point, it should be clear in the show's history that you and I are on the bandwagon of we have passed peak football.
Which, by the way, is totally true. And I'm gonna cut you off real shortly here because I find myself coming around on the Patriots. Is that weird? Because
yes.
I kind of like, I've stepped away from football because it's not interesting anymore. And now I'm able to look at it a little bit more objectively this year and go like, you know what? They're a good team. I'll admit it. Tom Brady, not a very, like, he doesn't seem like a likable guy, but, you know, he's good. He's got skills. And I think, like, when I think about, like, someone like Aaron Rodgers, for some reason, like, he seems like a super likable guy. I would hang out with the dude and probably thoroughly enjoy it. I don't think that's true with Tom Brady, but, like, he's a good athlete. And Belichick, he reminds me of our old football coach, where he's like, he understands the rules probably better than any other coach in the NFL at this point. Kind of mean, but effective, and which is probably why Brady isn't nice either, because that's been his mentor for the last however many years. But I'm just coming around to be like, you know what? I think they're one of the best of a dying league.
I'm gonna just stick to my guns on this one, James. But if you start cheering for the Patriots, you're no longer my brother.
I didn't say that. I'm to respect them. There's a difference. I think if I had to cheer for a team, I'd probably cheer for the Packers, which it seems to be working out at the moment.
The Packers. Yeah, you know, it's funny because you sent me an article that we're not going to talk about too much this morning about 365 and how they became Packers fans. And it was based on a number of different analytics factors and stuff. And I was thinking
He was a St. Louis Rams fan.
Yeah.
And obviously they moved back to L.A. this year. And so he was like, well, I need a new team, I guess. And yeah, so he started down this analytical path of like, hey, you know, I work for an analytical blog. We have all this information. Let's run this through a model and have it tell me who my team should be.
Yeah, which is funny and a clever way to do it. But I was thinking about why, like, I have a hard time. I've been thinking about where I am this year with football and how part of the reason why I'm so okay with the idea of like, I don't even want to pay attention to football this year isn't necessarily because I don't like the sport. Because anytime it's on, I always watch a player or two and think, this is fun. It'd be fun to get back into this. But what I'm realizing is that my dilemma and the reason why I'm frustrated with the sport is it's all about the fan bases. And like my and that's and the teams that I want to root for, two teams that I was curious and thinking of rooting for this year, the Raiders and the in Kansas City, it's the reason why I like them is because of the fans of those teams that I know are generally like humble and modest and just excited to have somebody else to cheer with them. They're not pricks about it. And and it's more about just say, hey, we're going to go have fun. We're going to go try really hard. We're probably going to lose, but that's fine. Whatever. It's not why we're doing this. And,
poor Raiders this year.
I know.
Oh,
I know.
That was hurt. Just hurts.
And the thing is, I think I'm going to have to next year pay attention again. But how I pay attention will change for the same reason that I started paying attention to sports in general, which was, everybody else around me was really curious. I just wanted to be up on a couple of teams, specifically the local teams, so that I could carry on conversations with people at work. Like, that was important, just to be able to socialize. Oh,
then I guess you have to go Raiders. You don't have a choice.
And that's kind of where I'm at. I'm feeling that that's my, like, it's, you know, Kansas City doesn't make sense in that context. But I,
Chargers are a little closer now, maybe.
I know. But I guess my point is it's like San Diego, like, is part of the San Diego Chargers were part of like the history and lore of the sport. And
55 years, apparently.
And it's like, and if you look back, like those old, like some of the great, like playoff games, like these series, these legendary games that you go and watch on ESPN Classics, like the San Diego Chargers are regularly a part of those. There's just history. Mm. It's steeped in history. And there's, and that's part of what makes this stuff fun. It's one of the reasons why baseball never changes how they count statistics. And the statistics are so important is because they are consistent. You're comparing the same statistics calculated the same way today as you were 100 years ago. And that historical context matters. And to a fan base, to people who are enthusiastic about whatever product you're selling, whether it's sports entertainment or an iPhone. And I feel like right now the NFL is like, I just, like you said, it's not fun to watch the sports in the stadium. Like, the stadium shouldn't be your primary concern right now, because that's not where most of the money's being made. But they wanted those sweet box seats, and they wanted the state cities to pay for it. So they, you know, so they're
gonna... the math just must still work that way, where you rake in, like, somehow the profit sharing must be such that the NFL or the owners or whoever gets to choose gets a significant portion of the stadium revenues and not as much from television and merchandise and all that other stuff. That must be what drives the decision then. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's not a money decision, but I don't know.
Well, it sounds like with San Diego, the city of San Diego is like, look, it doesn't make any financial sense for us to do this. Like, it's a bad deal. You're demanding too much. And the San Diego Chargers kept, and the NFL in general kept saying, look, we are like, you're not going to let the San Diego Chargers leave San Diego. And it was very much a game of chicken.
Oh.
And eventually, the city of San Diego called the bluff of the NFL, and the NFL went fine, because their concern is that, especially the team, the Chargers, their concern is the Raiders are going to leave the Bay Area. Their first choice is LA. Their second choice is Las Vegas.
Go.
I know, is Las, and so it was. So it's like this. It was like this weird. They were put into a.
I feel like they're destined for Las Vegas. It feels like that kind of team to me.
You know, but honestly, I kind of like the idea of like the Las Vegas Raiders. I can get behind that. I'm okay with this, and yeah, that would be so good. That'd be such a good. That could you imagine, like, because every team would go through and play in that stadium, and people would be like, "Oh, we're gonna go watch the game in Vegas," and you just make a big weekend.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez, that is like one of the few cities where
that'd be the worst stadium to visit if you weren't a drunkard partier type.
Yes, it's true. But I sit there and I shrug my shoulders, and I feel like that's one of the few cities in America where it actually like makes sense to put a stadium in that city,
except
and, like,
for the weather.
What do you mean? Just because it's hot?
It's
winter. Sports played in the winter. I
guess that's true.
I don't know.
That's true. What am I talking about? Yeah, we're good.
I just, whatever. It's stupid football. You know what, James, though? That's not why we're here this week. That's not what we're here to talk about. This week, like every week,
but we'll is interesting.
It is. It's fun to talk about. This week, like, it's funny. This reminds me of how this whole thing got started, this whole podcast, because originally we liked talking more about the video game companies and the products they were trying to sell than we liked talking about the video games they were making. Like, we weren't playing the games. We were talking about the companies, and that was what was interesting. And that's where I am with the NFL right now. I'm more curious about the league and the products they're selling than I am about the actual sports and the games. But This week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, I mean the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James got a short disclosure he wants to throw your way.
I founded and work for HPI, but do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions. I also own part of Twitter, Etsy, and Lending Club. And I was super excited the other day because I saw that like Lending, which was Etsy, was way up. And I was like, all right. And then I was like, oh, I'm still down 76%. Yeah.
You know, win some, you lose some, right? Yeah, not every day's an update, James.
Apparently not.
It's funny. If you want to follow us throughout the course of the week, not just when we're doing this show, I'm on Twitter at Matthew D. Furlow. My Instagram is Next Week in 4, where I'll post photos.
James Furlow everywhere. I got a new blog post coming out on Tuesday, I believe, where I will be reviewing the Amazon Echo.
Ooh, nice. So, I'm excited.
JamesFurlow.com.
I'll have to give it a little look-see.
If you're friends with me on any of those other places, you'll see it.
Nice. I am. Also, if you want more information just about what we talk about in the show here, we've got this great website. It's called thefurlowbros.com. All the clicks, links, articles that we talk about
is just furlowbros.com, by the way, not the furlowbros.
You're right.
That one.
Furlowbros.com. Don't put the
I don't know what would happen, but probably nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, everything we talk about this week is going to be there. If you want that delivered directly to your email box every week, it's a fantastic little weekly newsletter summary is what it becomes. And you can sign up for that. And it's really nice. It's free to you. It's our pleasure. You're welcome. So go check it out. And yeah, see what happens.
I wanted to start us off with a deep thought before getting into some of the bigger stories like Nintendo and iPhone and drones and stuff like that. This is by Paul Graham, probably one of my favorite VCs, venture capitalists to follow. It's probably been like over a year since he's written anything. It's one of the things I like about him. He's, you know, he only says something if he has something to say. He's not like, I gotta make a post. And it always feels like he's not always promoting some company that is inside of his accelerator. I think he's with the Y Combinator, if I remember correctly. Anyways, he writes this article. I'm going to read the whole thing because it's all of 4 paragraphs.
All right.
And it's good. And it's called The Risk of Discovery. Because biographies of famous scientists tend to edit out their mistakes, we underestimate the degree of risk they are willing to take. And because anything a famous scientist did that wasn't a mistake has probably now become the conventional wisdom, those choices don't seem risky either. Biographies, like Newton, for example, understandably focus more on the physics than alchemy or theology. The impression we get is that his unerring judgment led him straight to truths that no one else had noticed. How to explain all the time... And then so he had then asked the question, how do you explain all the time he spent on alchemy and theology? Well, smart people are often kind of crazy. But maybe there's a simpler explanation. Maybe the smartness and the craziness were not as separate as we think. Physics seems to us as a promising thing to work on, and alchemy and theology, I don't agree with this, obvious waste of time. But that's because we know how things turned out. In Newton's day, the three problems seemed roughly equally promising. No one knew yet what the payoff would be for inventing what we now call physics, which is kind of crazy. If they had, more people would have been working on it. And alchemy and theology were still in the then category that Marc Andreessen, okay, I like him too, he's another good one, he would describe as huge if true. I'm like, oh man, I love that. He goes, Newton made 3 bets, one of them worked out, but they were all risky. And man, just a good... deep thought for the day to be like, yeah, there's some things that when companies start working on them, they don't know if they're going to go on to be huge or fail. I think about like Google. They wanted to sell to Yahoo when they first got started because they were like, yeah, we've got this cool algorithm and that's it. They didn't want to risk starting a business or run all that. They had no idea what they had. And Yahoo had no idea what they had either, and which is why they're, making some changes, structural changes, I might say.
Yeah.
And so I just think it's an interesting thing, and I love just that idea of some of these companies when they're first getting started, like, no, you really don't know. And I love that Mark Andreessen concept. It's huge if true.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
That's like 3D printing, drones.
Yeah.
VR, right? That's how we feel about it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's a risky bet.
One of the things that's interesting to me is I actually was having a conversation about this today and about good engineering and elegant engineering and this idea of how when you're designing something that's very well designed, there is a simplicity to it and an elegance to it and an obviousness to it that really it's unfair to the inventor in retrospect, because it's like these things can sometimes seem so incredibly obvious afterwards and yeah. unavoidable. But yet if you forget what it was like to be on the other side of the problem and to sit there and look at it and be like, on the other side of the problem, this was not obvious. This was impossible. So the fact that they came up with the solution is, and it feels so natural is really, really, really impressive. And a particular conversation I was having was a year or two ago, my company, we sold a tool to a company in Spain. And for listeners who don't know, my company, we build these tools that we build are these very large semiconductor processing tools. They're like 10 feet tall, like 40 feet long, a couple Whoa. Feet deep. They're gigantic.
That's huge.
Things.
That's like put yeah. on a truck thing.
Oh, yeah. It's multiple boxes and multiple large containers.
IKEA style?
Actually, it's amazing how much they break down. Wow. They're not quite – especially considering that once they're installed, they never move. But so part of the whole premise of this thing is like we want these things to be maintainable and things you can work on. But there are some parts of it that just never fail, in particular, the electrical transformer. Electrical transformer is this 400-pound giant chunk of metal that sits at the bottom of the entire tool. And you pretty much have a frame. You put the transformer in first. Well, then there's nothing else there. And then you build the furnace around the transformer. The entire thing is designed on this premise of it's the only thing that doesn't fail. So you don't have to worry about it, which of course means 2 years ago, there was a manufacturing defect in one of the transformers and it caught on fire and exploded.
Whoa.
It didn't ruin the furnace. It ruined some of the electrical work, which we were able to fly out and fix right away. But that one transformer was no longer working, which means a quarter of the tubes of the tool's capacity was down and we needed to fix that. And the reason why I bring this up is we ended up designing these like cool roller systems that allowed us just like pull it out and move it out. We were able to do it in like a half hour and it was really, you know, it's nice. And we've got this cool, yeah, uneventful. And we got this tool lying around. But what's crazy is like if you don't know what these tools are normally like, you don't understand that when we found out we had to remove a transformer, the first solution we all came up with was, okay, how do we disassemble this entire tool, like unbuild it so we can get to it and get it out? And it's just interesting to me that like it's the risk of discovery thing is this idea of it is very unfair to when things become conventional wisdom or they're super elegant design things, to think that they were easy or to not appreciate what went into designing it.
Yeah.
Considering the fact that like in retrospect, it does seem obvious, but what's the opposite of retrospect?
Yeah.
Prespect? Inspect.
Well, it's like if you're like doing a construction project and you're trying to do something and it's like super hard, you're like, there should be a tool for this. And then you see the tool, you're like, yes, that's the tool. And it's like, and you can tell like this, they went through the exact same thing that I went through, which led them to create this tool, which is now perfect for this. Thank you. And so you do appreciate it in those microcosms.
Insane.
Of experiences, but
and it's yeah, it's really interesting. That is a really interesting point, and how common that is. That it's like, you know, it just how hard it is to appreciate
But how many different types of hammers and shovels were there before we came to the one where everyone went, oh yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's also the other thing is that it, like, the other part of that is like how many, you know, dead ends you go on before regularly you fail.
Well, that's
before.
What we see with startups, right? Yeah. That's when a startup goes down. We're going to talk about a drone startup later today. And that's an example of a company. They tried it one way. It didn't work. They figured out how to not to run a drone company.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know.
So speaking of a company that's ready to take a risk.
I almost want to switch these two topics, if that's all right.
Oh, okay. Sure, yeah, that's cool.
Just because I feel like...
Companies that want to take a risk, there's one that took a risk 10 years ago. Yeah.
So this is hilarious to me because we talked to you asked last week, like, when was it? When did the iPhone come out? I was like, it was March. And then
I know.
And then like a day later, the 10-year anniversary of the iPhone, which I'm technically correct. It came out months later. It actually went on sale months later. But
it was announced.
Yes, it was in January. Like, immediately after CES, which was just this.
You're both right. How
about exactly. That?
That's the equivalent of like, we're the first university on the West. Well, we're the first university west of the Mississippi.
Yeah.
Wait.
Yeah. One was founded first.
We're the first college on the West. Wait. Okay. There's some subtle differences there.
Yeah. That's because mine is, yeah.
We're the first accredited organization on the West.
But it's like, yeah, because your college, right. My college, and our friend Brian's college, all three of them are claimed to be the first college in the West. And it was, one was founded first, one was accredited first, and one was accredited with the United States federal government first.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like, oh man, but lawyers and nightmare.
I know, right? Yeah, hey, it counts. It's a tagline.
Hey, whatever.
Yeah. So but anyways, yeah, so Steve Jobs announced the iPhone 10 years ago today, and I think it was, I don't know about you, but I went back and I watched a big portions of the keynote.
I tried to find it for about 30 seconds, and I didn't go on YouTube, which is probably my mistake.
Yeah, that was weird. Why did you do that?
I don't know. I saw a link. I was like, oh, yeah. I tried clicking on it, and then it was just a description of it without linking back to the original one, and I was like, oh, well, okay.
Yeah. It is.
It's probably amazing to watch. I should go rewatch it.
I don't know. It left this weird feeling in me, and
really,
yeah, because it is amazing how different that company is from Apple today.
Okay, tell me more.
It's one of those things where I got rid
of the name computer.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's and not necessarily Steve Jobs. Was so good at making the pitch, making the argument. And this is similar to the we had this conversation towards the end of last year when Apple came out with when they announced no more headphone jack. And I made the argument that the issue wasn't that they got rid of the headphone jack. It was how they sold it. They didn't go through. And I walked through Apple's announcement of the MacBook Air when they got rid of the CD player. And I compared and contrasted Steve Jobs getting rid of a fundamental, you know, port versus current Apple getting rid of a port.
A little chiller.
But courage.
One word.
I know. Oh, geez. But it's even more stark with the announcement of the iPhone. And I think what's interesting, especially in the context of the risk of discovery, this idea of, you know, the iPhone and the type of devices that we have today, they seem so obvious now. They seem like they were inevitable, and they weren't. They just... It's unfair to say that that's the direction we were going to go.
Was that famous Steve Ballmer clip of him just being like, a $600 phone with no keyboard? Are you kidding me? It's like, no way. We feel very good about our offering and what we're doing. This will amount to nothing. I mean, and I mean that, and he wasn't, he was the most over the top about it, but he was not the only one thinking.
Well, I actually came up with a list of the naysayers, or Macula News came up with a list of it, and it's fantastic. iPhone just doesn't matter anymore. There are now alternatives to the iPhone, which has been introduced elsewhere or everywhere else in the world. It's no longer a novelty. That was in 2008, so just a year later. In May 21st, 2017, what does the iPhone offer that other cell phones do not already offer or will offer soon? The answer is not very much. Apple stated a goal of selling 10 million iPhones by the end of 2008. Seems ambitious. Motorola, I know.
Oh, man, I love it.
I know. Motorola's then chairman and then CEO, Ed Zander, said his company was ready for the competition with the Apple iPhone due out the following month. How do you deal with that? Zander was asked at the Software 2007 conference. Zander quickly retorted, how do they deal with us? The iPhone is going to be nothing more than a temporary novelty that will eventually wear off. Apple should pull the plug on the iPhone. What Apple risks here is its reputation as a hot company that can do no wrong. If it's smart, it will call the iPhone a, quote, reference design and pass it to some suckers to build with someone else's marketing budget. Then it can wash its hand of any marketing or marketplace failures. Otherwise, I'd advise people to cover their eyes. You're not going to like what you see. That was John Dvorak, who is
John Dvorak. He's always good for a quote.
Well, and
I love how Mac Daily News too. Bloated gas bag.
Yeah.
But you know what? That's pretty accurate.
Yeah,
he's a cranky old man.
He is. He's really good at getting clicks, though. I'm more convinced than ever that after the initial frenzy of public publicity, the sales of two early adopters, iPhone sales will be unspectacular. iPhone may well become Apple's next Newton. That was from Computer World. There's an old saying, stick to your knitting, and Apple is not a mobile phone manufacturer. That's not their knitting. I think people overreacted to it. There was not a lot of tremendously new stuff, if you think about it. The iPhone's
just the right new stuff, I guess.
I know. The iPhone's willful disregard.
This is awesome.
I know. The iPhone's willful disregard of global handset markets will come back to haunt Apple. I know. The iPhone
for a
is
year.
Exactly. The iPhone is nothing more than a luxury babble that will appeal to a few gadget freaks.
Wow.
In terms of its impact on the industry, the iPhone is less relevant. Apple is unlikely to make much of an impact on this market. Apple will sell a few to its fans, but the iPhone won't make a long-term mark on the industry. This is so good. And then they ended with the best of all time. The Palm CEO, and he actually said this a month and a half before the announcement. We've learned and struggled for a few years here figuring out how to make a decent phone. PC guys are not going to just figure this out. They're not going to just walk in.
Three years later,
Palm was gone just as a company. Oh, jeez. It is just unbelievable. And one of the things that I've really noticed, and I'm coming back to what Steve Jobs was very, very, very good at, is this idea of building a case. And, you know, the kind of the classic quote from the keynote was that it's a three devices. We're announcing three devices today, a touchscreen iPod, a phone device, and an internet communications device. And then he started going through all three of these, like, you know, points again and again and again. He goes, like, are you getting it? And everybody, like, loses their mind. That's the other thing, is there was a lot more, like, real, like, excitement in the audience, which
I'm supposed to clap at this feature now.
Yeah, exactly. It was just, like, honest enthusiasm there.
Pretty awesome. Let's be honest. Well, I remember, one of my favorite tech writers who I like to follow, MG Siegler, he was covering tech stuff and he watched the announcement. I was like, meh, whatever. And then he went into an Apple store just to play with it, to confirm, like, yeah, I hate this thing. And he walked out with one. And it was at that moment where he went, okay, I think they're onto something.
Yeah.
And I remember for me, they launched it in March, and it was like around Thanksgiving. I think I was at home.
Yeah.
And I was looking for a smartphone because I was like, I want to do this thing. And I had picked out the Palm Curve, I think is
what
I
remember that.
And I was like, I'm going to get this, and I'm going to try to run my internet all off this phone and not have a router, which was a dumb idea. But but I was like, well, there's this new iPhone thing. Let me check it out. And I played with it and went, yeah, this is the phone. And I bought the phone.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, I don't, just, man.
To me, it was my girlfriend at the time when she bought an iPhone as a, like, a college kid. And, like, or she didn't buy it, her parents bought it for her, but it was really important for her to have
she
it.
She got one.
Yeah, we can say the important part was that it's, like, it was this, and it was, like, the second year, it was the second generation one that she got, but it was, like, this idea that it wasn't just a tool for business people, that there was a real mass market appeal that people were just really missing out on. And it's so amazing. And it's just remarkable to me how unobvious it was at that time to so many people. And Steve Jobs knew that. He knew it wasn't obvious. He knew that if it wasn't designed right, and if the right features weren't put out, and just the right features, that people wouldn't understand it and understand what it was all about. And so he had to, you know, in just the way that, like, that he made the case for the iPhone in his announcement, and talking about how, you know, the mobile internet experience on the iPhone was worse than the rest of a lot of your other devices at
from
the time.
Speed, because it was edge.
It was edge, and they had no flash. It was edge, but even, like, if you remember, I remember the idea was that it could use the real internet. It wasn't going to use mobile, these, like, websites optimized for mobile. So a lot of times your BlackBerries, you know, if you were going to go to one, if there was a website that had this mobile, this super light mobile website, you could go there and be more efficient and effective on a BlackBerry than on an iPhone. It was just an ugly website. And Steve Jobs, like, part of his brilliance was recognizing the fact that, no, we don't want to give people the option for this mobile website. We want to give them, I don't even care that it's a degraded, like, internet experience. Like, we want to give them the best full experience that we can. And there were so many choices that were made that that were big compromises and were criticisms. And I think that's the interesting part to me, is that, like, a lot of the criticisms of the other company were born out of, like, not idiots. We laugh at them now because they were so woefully wrong, but it wasn't like they were at the time. Well, they were obviously wrong. No, they had, you know, Palm had been doing it for a long time. They had worked on a bunch of different solutions. Like, they were coming from a position of people that were very successful in that particular market.
Well, this was the classic, like, Henry Ford, where he was like, when we interviewed people, they wanted better buggy whips.
Right, exactly.
You know, and that's, Palm had done all this market research, and everyone was like, we want a better tactile keyboard.
Right. Yeah. And, yeah. I mean,
they had the research to back it up.
Right.
I get it.
Whereas Apple was like, well, and it's funny because it's like what everybody wanted was a tactile keyboard and a bigger screen. And it was, Apple was like, no, we can actually build a good enough virtual keyboard and then just have the biggest screen. And that idea, and he makes the case for that idea of, like, we're not going to, you're like, you know, using a stylus. He's like, you got the 10 styluses on your fingers or on your hands.
Oh my gosh,
and what was, and I loved it so, I loved it. It's funny because we completely forgot about the fact that, like, when they pitched the iPad, one of the reasons why they talked about not doing the smaller iPad mini is because they're like, how would you, like, the iPad's the perfect size. Like, if it were any smaller, you wouldn't be able to touch the buttons. Not, like, forgetting the fact that, like, and somehow
we all had a 3.5-inch one in our pocket.
Worked fine. Like, what's going on here? And it's Well, and he was just he was so good at that, at making the case in such a way that you kind of went, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And making you feel okay with it and telling you about the future and why you should like and getting you excited for what was going to be coming without actually telling you what was coming. I it's just an amazing product and an amazing product reveal. And one of the things that he did, and this was like, how did he do that? How did he do what I just said? How did he get you excited about what was coming without actually telling you what was coming? One of the ways that he did that was by saying, we have put OS X into the iPhone. Now it's a somewhat slimmed down, but it has all of these different technologies that we've built for OS X in it. Basically what he was saying was, look, you're going to get it and it can't do that much. But the foundation is there for everything the Mac can do. The iPhone can theoretically do as well. And that's the direction we're going. That's what we're trying to build.
He was going for that.
And that is not something that they did with the Apple Watch. They weren't able to infer the future of the Apple Watch very well without telling you what the actual future was. And, you know, Tim Cook at Mac Daily News has given them the moniker of Pipeline Tim, because Tim Cook always talks about how, like, we got a great pipeline coming and is never really able to, like, subtly infer what that pipeline is. It's just really becoming obvious that.
Well, that was the big difference. That's the big difference between Cook and Jobs. Jobs had a philosophy, an ideology, and he could just talk to that. And not have to mention a specific product, but you could understand how we saw the world and through that go, oh.
Yeah.
And you could insert your own vision for what that world would look like. Again, like with the OS X idea, you could imagine what it would do someday. He didn't have to tell you that.
Right.
And whereas Cook just like he doesn't think of the world like that. He's a product guy, and he's just thinking of what are the next features, the next versions. And it's clear in their products that doesn't have this overall vision. It's like, why the Touch Bar? How does that fit in with the Mac? Like, where are you taking this thing?
Right.
Tell me more about the philosophy. Why get rid of the headphone jack? Tell me more about this overlying idea and direction that we're headed in. And he doesn't think that way
and
can't talk to it. And Jobs totally did.
And I think what's worse,
to him, the features were a second.
I think
not a first thing.
Exactly. Features were a product of the philosophy that drove the innovation. Exactly. And whereas you're right, whereas it very much feels like the features are the thing right now at Apple. Like, well, these are cool features. Check out all these features. And that was just been it's a dangerous game to play, because it doesn't inspire people. It doesn't get them excited. And
Well, you're not going to come up with novel solutions.
Right.
And that's what I think. That's what I liked about the book Bold, where he was like, you have to come up with big problems and that will lead to interesting solutions. And I tried to do this with my team recently, where we were kind of churning, doing our same thing, making incremental improvements. And we refresh our model every quarter, essentially. And it takes 3 weeks to do it.
Right.
And so I sat down with the team and I said, okay, let's get crazy. What would it look like to refresh this thing every day?
Right.
What would we do differently in order to make that happen? And ultimately, they were all kind of like deer in the headlights. What are you talking about? Because someone at one point in time posed the question, what would it look like to refresh this thing once a month? And everyone was just like, this is all we would do.
Right.
And because 3 weeks is the perfect timeline, and it's not always that. And so that's where I went, well, if it was once a day, what would you change to make that possible? And we came up with a completely different architecture in order to make it happen. And it's something where and now we're building that new architecture. And it's one where we don't have to refresh it once a day, but if we wanted to, we could. And now it's something that's significantly more robust. It's a lot more straightforward. It's easier. But the only way, like, it's no longer in Excel. We're using a programming language on a server where everyone has access to it and can read and write into it. Whereas before it was people emailing me Excel files and linking them together and crossing my fingers that didn't make an error. And so it's completely different. But it was stemmed from this conversation of me saying, yeah, once a month is great. Let's talk about once a day. Let's go crazy here. And I feel like you have to have someone pushing that kind of question. I think Google does a pretty good job of that, where they will say something like, what if you never drove ever? What if we got rid of the steering wheel? Okay, you no longer have a failsafe. How would you make this work?
Right.
And all of a sudden you're inventing a new different type of LiDAR in order to make it happen.
Right.
And it sends you down that type of path. But you have to have someone saying, like, what if we could do this? I genuinely feel like at one point in time, Jobs would have been like, what if it was the thickness of a piece of paper? What if it was bendable?
Right, yeah.
What would you do differently?
Yeah.
And you may even go down the path of like, well, I wouldn't have any of the internals in it. Maybe AR is the answer to that. And you literally do have a piece of paper or some whatever you want, and it's projected on there. All the guts and thinking is done somewhere else. And I don't know, but like you need someone asking that. What if it's this, like with a watch? Okay, fitness tracker, done, cool. I'm sure you can add new features. You can be more precise. You can do all this cool stuff. And, you know, that's neat. But you need someone to say, but why, like, what's up with a watch? What bugs us about them today? And you can still feel it where you're like, there's something there. I know it's there. I just can't put my finger on it yet.
I can say, and I think one of the brilliances of the iPhone, and this is what I think is so, one of the things that Steve Jobs was so good at, oh my gosh, this was such a great idea, was calling it an iPhone. Because that's not what it was. That's not what it's ever been. Like, everybody was astutely aware of the fact that it wasn't a phone. Even the way he described it, it wasn't a phone. But he knew that people needed a context that they understood to think about it, that would act as the grounding principle from which they could grow their understanding and they could move forward. And so even though it's a terrible name because it is not representative of what the device is, it was a great name from a marketing perspective. It is going to compete against smartphones. It's the Apple's smartphone. We'll call it the iPhone. and therefore completely changed. And this is what was so great about it was, even though it is a misnomer, what ended up happening was what the word phone means changed to keep up with the iPhone. Now we think of phones are mobile computers. That's that, you know, or pocket computers. Maybe it's a better category, but that's what a phone is. It's just it's a computer that you keep in your pocket, and it's not the thing that you pick up off the wall and talk on. It just so happens it's one of the features of the modern phone. And I think what with the watch, I still like the watch and I like the idea of it. And and this is what frustrates me about the company is that I think what they recognized was that they said, look, what we want is to sell we want every single person to buy a vitals tracker. We want everybody to be constantly monitoring their vitals, not their fitness, but their vitals. We want to be able to have these massive data sets.
It's a medical device.
And we want to make this thing so alluring that people will go out and buy a medical device for themselves and just keep it with them at all times. And we want it to be like they have that vision. That is what they're trying to build. And it's a really cool vision. It's actually I like it. It gets me excited. And I think it's an important thing to be building. And I think that everybody else who stays in the market has to keep up with them. I think there's a real I think it's very interesting that the only other company that's really succeeding in the same space as Apple is a fitness tracking company. It's not other smartwatch companies, because both of those companies understand that that is actually something unique and different. And if you can make that fun and sexy and cool and interesting and alluring, you can go somewhere with it. And on top of it, I don't have the article, of course, but Fitbit bought another smartphone or app or smartwatch company this week.
Because, in addition to Pebble, huh?
Yeah, because what they've realized is that what you need to they've decided that Apple's on the right track in that what is a good idea is to build a really complex, robust medical device that has a couple other features on top of that. But the problem that I'm having with Apple right now is like they're not doing a good job of like explaining it. Hey, this is where we're going with it. It is a wirelessly connected device that does a couple of small, like has a few interactive capabilities, but it's primarily a health thing. It's primarily a medical device. And that's,
by the way, I actually see it could become two other things that could be huge. If true.
Yeah. Like what?
The first one, and it's really having spent more time using Amazon's Echo. I think it could be a fantastic personal assistant, and they need to think of it in that term. It's this thing that, does what a personal assistant would do, where you can ask it questions, you can ask it to do things, which, yeah, a lot of that is dependent on Siri and learning a lot of new skills quick. But I think it's even more powerful on your watch than it would be on any other device because you're out and about, you're doing something. And I think that would be a big deal to be able to manage things like that, which is all software related. I get that, but to have it easily accessible. And then the other one is to be used as, I would say, a remote for your other devices in your home.
Yeah.
And just in the sense that you can move around and it's got the sensors in it to know what it is that you're doing to stop music or raise the volume or do all sorts of stuff to maybe, I'm not left-handed, but you could write in theory and it could be able to figure out what it is that you're writing because you do write with your wrist. You don't write with your fingers. And to be able to track some of those things. And it would be a cool thing about like Nintendo Switch. Like it could be something that works with games too, where you could have some sort of driving or gaming type of thing and it could work that way. And I could even see where you have some sort of other wristband on your other wrist and it suddenly becomes very interesting, very quick because it's watching both your arms. But, I totally like, I could see it going that route in addition to the fitness tracking.
Yeah.
Personal assistant thing could be big.
I still stand that for all its brilliance, the modern phone is the wrong size screen. I still think that in 10, 20 years, that's going to be one of those obviously like, oh, that was, how did we deal? Like, we'll look back at this era of smartphones as this laughable period where how did people use devices that looked like that? That's crazy. You kept it in your pocket with a screen that small? That doesn't even make sense. Like, and I think that that's one of those ones that the solution for that problem is not one that I have. Like, I
want it in reality.
I know. Well, that's part of the problem is everybody always like, whenever I say that, they're always like, yeah, but what else? I'm like, I don't know. I just know this is wrong. Like I feel it in my bones. And I think to me, for me, an acceptable solution is an internet connected watch and a computer, like a big screen. But the phone is a compromise to bridge the gap that is just not there. And bringing it back to this, like the risk of discovery and the idea of being able to see it forward, like it's clearly so not the answer to me, but there's such a precedent that people can't even think outside, can't think of that context, that this is going to go away eventually. I don't know.
When you get companies like Apple where they don't want to think about that.
Exactly. Now we're into Steve Jobs' favorite idea of the innovator's dilemma. You know, they innovated. They created something really new and unique and disrupted the entire field and became the market leaders. And now they don't want to disrupt again because they'd be disrupting themselves. And that's, you know, it's not normally what you want to do with a business, except that is what you want to do for a business, because otherwise somebody else will come and be the innovator and will show everybody else how to do it. and you'll get left behind.
You'll get all the dollars.
Exactly. Yeah. And so Apple's AR solution is going to be one that's iPhone based, even though it's the wrong size screen. Like
maybe that's a nice size computer to keep in your pocket.
I'm conflicted. I'm conflicted because I think that's actually.
And what if the screen didn't have to be as big anymore? Because you've got something like AR, and they could make it more of a pill-sized type of thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's just, man, it is such a bummer that Steve Jobs died. Like, he just, love him or hate him, he was so much fun to watch. And you know, guys like Elon Musk and Bezos and Larry Page, like, they have a lot of those similar traits.
Yeah, they do.
And I think
Elon Musk has his why. He's got that bigger purpose, and it's like pretty straightforward, which is nice. But everything he does is in that context, yeah. And that's super helpful.
I think, and it's funny. I think it's Satya Nadella. I think is similar in his like may I his. I think Steve Jobs and Elon Musk are fun because they both had these like really lofty ideas that they were, that is their reason to be. Whereas guys,
they had
like
a desire to change humanity.
Right. Whereas like Satya Nadella and I think Jeff Bezos to a large extent too, they are crystal clear on what they want their business to be.
More like, pragmatic.
Yeah, it's exactly. And so it's not quite as lofty, but it's fun to watch because it makes sense. It has a context.
Yeah.
Page in Alphabet/Google in general is kind of cool because it's now this fractured beast. Or one of it is this, like, let's change the humanity sort of part of the rest of Alphabet. And then there's Google, which is like we have one thing that we're trying to do. We're trying to become the computer from Star Trek. Period. That's what we want.
Pretty much.
And
pretty straightforward.
And
everything's in order, and now we will give it life.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the marching orders. It's... I don't know.
Did you see that Google Voice is potentially going to be getting an update?
That's what I've heard.
And I think everyone has set their expectations way too high.
You know what though? What was my prediction, James? Was that they'd have more communication platforms by the end of the year than they started. And so I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good about where we're going.
I don't know. I'm still on my consolidation side of the
house.
Look, if they just set it up so that they can do MMS, actually like be able to text a photo back and forth, that would be amazing to me. That's the only feature I want.
Yeah, well, it's the only feature everybody wants, James.
I use Google Voice with my rental property stuff, and as someone will be like, "Yeah, I send you a picture of it." I'm like, great. Let me go to email. Let me open it up. And then I can't send one back, which is super annoying. Like, I'll email that to you. But anyways, fix it. So, how about a company that is taking a risk with a new product, and I'm not sure where it lands on the spectrum. It's definitely a risk, no doubt about that. Is it part of a bigger vision? Is it just for survival? And I am talking about Nintendo's Switch. So they made some announcements, I guess.
Yeah.
They showed off another cool video of people using it. They gave out the price and the launch date, I believe.
Which is there? So everybody
paid really close attention.
So we're all on the same page here. The Switch is the new Nintendo console that you'll be able to buy. It's like it's the replacement for the Wii. Notice how I didn't say the Wii U.
I was actually about to correct you. Like, I think it's the Wii U, actually. There was one in between. It's kind of like with the GameCube. We're just not going to worry about that one.
You know what's funny? I wonder if this will happen in retrospect as with the Wii U as well. But it is amazing how many people give glowing reviews and talk about how their favorite system they've ever owned was the GameCube.
Really?
And yeah, there's a real big crowd for that. I mean, part of it is you never owned a GameCube.
It's a small crowd.
Well, that's part of the problem.
People love N64 and specifically GoldenEye.
Yeah, yeah. And then that's another funny one. I actually watched a really long video about Halo and how Halo like what Halo did to become as mammoth as it was. And it's another one of those innovators that came along that, in retrospect, every single shooter, like, uses the same control style, uses a lot of the same, like, there's so, it did such a good job at finally, like, making that type of game, like, this is how the game should be built, that, like, it's now the standard. It just won. And everything else before it, like, you know, GoldenEye, like, it doesn't even make sense. Like, that's such a good game. So the Switch, what are we going to talk about?
So, five announcements. So is it's coming March 3rd.
Yes, sir.
Is my guess. Soon. They gave out some specs. It's the 6.2 inch screen.
So it's 300 bones for the console. And what it is, for those of you who are paying no attention, which is fine, it's a convertible mobile device. There's this little cradle that the device sits in, and that cradle connects
only if you pay an extra $70.
I'm pretty sure it comes with it, doesn't it?
Are you sure about that?
No, I'm not sure.
Let's see. The Pro controller costs $70. A pair of new Joy-Cons costs $80, or you can buy one on your own. A charging grip costs $30. The Switch dock will be $90 with a Wii-esque wheel that'll run $15 for a setup too.
Interesting. Well, so anyways, cradle. So this dock thing basically allows you to plug it into your TV, and so it'll,
which essence Nintendo's saying is an accessory.
Yes. This is primarily a mobile device. And then, like, it's got controllers that, like, click onto the side of it. Like you said, it has its own capacitive touch screen. They caught up with the future, and it's a 1280 by 72 resolution display, with up to 1080p output available on the TV. It's got 32 gigs of internal storage. It charges with USB-C. It's expandable with micro SD. If it sounds a bit like a tablet piece or like a mobile tablet, that's because it basically is one.
Is it bad that I'm considering spending $300 for two games?
No. Okay. Which two?
I bet you can guess.
Zelda and Mario.
Yep. They look like a ton of fun.
Yeah, they do. I
probably get sucked into a sport game or two as well, because that's who I am. But
right. Yeah, this is really interesting. So those are some of the specs. We learned about these. The controllers are really interesting. So the idea of this thing is it looks kind of like a Sega Genesis. Not a Sega Genesis. A Game Gear.
Whoa.
Sega Game Gear, where it's a big screen in the middle, and then it has controllers that, like, can, like, slide onto the edges of it, like, lock onto the edges of it. They can come off. They can be used separately. So, like, you can play multiplayer where one person is controlling it. Like, you should just go take a look at the picture of this. If I'm doing a bad job of describing it, it's got these little ears that are actually remote controllers. They slide off of it. Each one has a joystick and a number of numbers and arrows and stuff. Like, inside it has shoulder buttons, but basically what it allows you to do is it allows two people to play, a co-op where you have two controllers, or you can, like, snap it into together and use them for more complex games, more complex controls. You can use them in combination and play that way. Like you said, there's a bunch of games that are coming out. There's this thing called 1-2 Switch, which is a party style game. It's one of these multiplayer games, and it's a classic.
It's like their preview game, right?
It's a classic Apple showing off it's a very unique idea. It's a very unique idea. But it's in the kind of game it is, but it's specifically to show off what the console is capable of. They have a couple other games that people are excited about. Splatoon 2, ARMS, which is like a boxing game. But there's also, what is it? EA's FIFA is coming to it, which will be pretty cool. They'll also have the Elder Scroll 5 Skyrim, which, if you get this system, James, I suggest you get Skyrim.
I hear Skyrim's pretty good.
It's fantastic. I love that game. NBA, Minecraft is coming. Good news, thank goodness. Sega's upcoming Project Sonic 2017, which I thought I was going to have to buy the Switch for, and then I found out that it comes out with the PlayStation 4, and that's what I'll buy it on. They've got an upgrade in Mario Kart 8, which is coming.
Mario Kart 8?
I know. And then, yeah, and then and Nintendo has also noted that over 50 companies have expressed interest in creating games for the Switch, with over 60 or with over 80 games already in development.
So not that many at launch, and potentially more later.
Yeah. So, which is, you know, pretty good, I guess.
Which I read a review on Ars Technica. Wow. Sorry, guys. and it was interesting. The main takeaway is jack of all trades, master of some.
Okay.
And I mean, his whole big thing is like as a portable gaming device, he's like fantastic. Once you use this screen as a portable device, your phone will seem small in comparison, which it comes back to your comment of it's the wrong size.
Yeah.
And because he's like, it looks great. And he's like, and the DS and the Wii U look like garbage.
Yeah. That's the thing. I'm going to say that actually might be how they get me on board is my DS is a little long in the tooth and I could see.
Yeah. I could get that. He's like, it looks great. It's awesome. He goes, but when you plug it into your TV using the $90 dock, are you kidding me? He's like, it looks like the Wii U graphics. Right. There's like no change essentially from then. And he's like, and that didn't look great when it got started. And so he's essentially like, Nintendo is conceding the home console, still going to own the portable one. At the same time, making an option for a home console. He's like, they're not saying it that way, but that's effectively what they're done. And then he does say that the Joy-Cons, which are like, come on, guys, really?
I know, they're so funny with their naming conventions. They're just controllers.
It's a Wiimote. No, it's a Joy-Con. It's, yeah. Anyways, he goes, there are some ways to use it where it's like, it's actually pretty nice. It's not bad. His only annoyance are the bumper buttons, I guess. He's like, they're not very good.
Mm.
He says, when you turn them sideways, like to do the two-player thing like you were talking about, he's like, that's horrible.
Really? Like,
imagine you take the old Nintendo controller and shrink it down to about half the size, make that work. He goes, oh, and you know how all those are all a nice line and they all kind of work? He goes, these aren't. It's not made for horizontal plays. Like, you're going to hate it. But vertically, it's not bad. He's like, and if you take them off, he's like, then they're like compact Wiimotes. He's like, that's actually not bad at all. But
yeah, I think that I could totally see doing that where, like, I could see having the dock, having it plugged into my TV and sitting back. The thing that I think is interesting is that Nintendo, not only are they this is like, it's funny that people would pitch it as this is the conceding the consoles to Sony and Microsoft. Like, they did that at the end of the Wii. Like, they've never caught up. That's not a market they're effectively competing in. What's really interesting to me, though, is that NVIDIA is never going to build a truly competitive device because this is NVIDIA's console. And NVIDIA has been trying to get going this idea of like an Apple TV competitor or an Android TV competitor, something that has really high end graphics compared to that allows for complex, large games. It doesn't have the processing power or the cost of the PlayStation 4 or the Xbox
bones.
I know.
And if you want to play it at home, it's actually $400.
Yeah. Well,
it's a $90.
Hey, chill out.
So I don't know. Is it cheaper?
Slow your roll, James. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, this is, it's, but the idea being.
But it's portable. I get that.
But the idea that here is
I need to go fly more often is what I need to do.
I know, that's how
but I'm still kind of living in the wonderment of having an iPad on the airplane. I'm like, this is amazing. I can watch a movie.
This does, right. This does bring up an interesting point, though, that's kind of frustrating, which is that the battery life, depending on how graphically intense the game is between 3 hours and 6 hours, which is a pretty short flight, all things considered.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
And which means you'll need a battery backup or to be able to plug into the plane. And it's
or have a phone on hand. So yeah, you play Super Mario Run.
Right. Yeah. Which is kind of where I. So it's.
I beat the game, by the way. I just want to put that out there.
For congratulations! The you're
save
awesome.
The princess. I'm good to go. I did not collect all the different types of coins yet.
Yet.
Slowly working on it. The green ones are stupid hard. I honestly have not collected a single set of green coins. I'm only working on the first level. I don't even know where two of them are, to be honest. Even if I wanted to collect them, I couldn't. And I think I've mastered getting one of the green coins so far.
Oh, jeez. Like,
for whatever reason, that step up was a little more than I was ready for. So,
which I think is why they do it that way.
Yeah, it's for the truly hardcore gamers. Because I was doing all great. Like, oh, dude, I'm going to collect all these. It's going to be great. And then, no. Shut me down. Yeah. But anyways. Yeah, that's not very long. I'm thinking later in the future of my life when we're rolling down to California, taking an 11-hour trip. That's not a super long time to be playing. But I don't think I want them playing video games the whole trip anyways, so maybe it's okay.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's a portable console in so
far. What it means is you can't say, you get to play for 3 hours, then your brother gets to play for 3 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Well, except and the car is an interesting one because you have an outlet. You can actually power it the whole time. I think
cars are actually good. Yeah, I guess I can take the controllers off and they each get a controller, play some co-op or something, or kill each other. I don't know.
So that's interesting.
Did I tell you we're thinking about getting a van? Yeah, I've told you all that.
Yeah. I told you which van you need to get. Chrysler's coming out with one.
No, I'm not buying new.
So
on Craigslist, I found a $3,000 van. Woo! That's right up my alley. I saw one for $500, and I was like, hey, the guy said it doesn't run. Like, okay, I'm cool with that. I wonder what's wrong with it. Like, I know a mechanic. This exactly. could work out really well.
That's funny. That's really funny. So the other thing, one of the other big things that they changed on this thing is that it's going to have online play. You can actually
Oh my gosh, is it actually going to be good online play or like kill me online play?
So that
like
is
their current, like even Super Mario Run, like here, text me your friend code.
So what? Yes, it's going to be terrible.
Excellent.
Yeah. You can do like local co-op, which means you can actually connect 8 of the devices over an ad hoc wireless.
Did you say
network.
8 devices?
8 of them. So you can play with 8 of your friends. And
that's kind
of
cool.
It is kind of cool. So and the idea there being that it's like good for competitive playing and like esports stuff. Which is pretty neat. It's actually a pretty sophisticated little ad hoc network that they got going on. The other thing, for their online service, they're actually going to charge for it. It's going to be behind a paywall. It will.
Yeah, but everyone's doing that. So
right. Well, yeah, the PC gamers. So basically Reddit's freaking out because they're like, oh my gosh, it's the end of the world. Like, dude, this stuff's not free. Like, it's not free.
If it makes it better. Cool.
Exactly. That's why I'm like, it doesn't bother me at all that PlayStation charges for theirs, because it's really solid and it's like it's cohesive. Well,
PlayStation
it
charges,
well.
Xbox charges. Yeah. I don't see a problem.
And it's not absurd. $60. The other two charge $60 a year. If Nintendo charges something similar, that's not crazy. You'll be able
probably
to
charge $50 just because they're like that.
Yeah, probably. They're going to give members a free game, one NES or a Super NES download per month, which is not,
that's cool.
Yeah, that's not nothing.
That's really cool, actually. Yeah. That's a way of boosting your library.
Exactly. There are going to be planned discounts and other software deals to make
Dude,
a member
Ocarina
more appealing.
Of Time. Oh, wait, that's not NES, Super NES. That's right. Yeah. Never mind.
Sorry, buddy.
Sorry, buddy.
But they, I'm in total agreement where it's like, if that makes it better, if that allows them to justify putting a lot of engineering expertise behind it because it's a profit center, then yeah, do it. Don't make
or
it
if
awful.
Not very many people sign up, then you're just like, it goes down the rat hole because they don't have the funds to make it worth it.
Exactly.
I mean, that's like pretty much. From what I understand, if you buy an Xbox, like you're getting a gold account, like that's how that works.
Oh yeah,
and you're dumb if you don't.
Yeah,
and
you get them together.
And
the games are.
And it's one of those things where they've got this recurring profit thing going, that helps fund all of the development and to keep it good and to keep people going. So it's a virtuous cycle.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I get the idea that people don't like to have to pay a subscription in order to get their device to work. Like, I understand that you don't like
There's
that.
There's also a concern with who your demographic is. Like Xbox and Sony clearly going after people who have money to pay $60 a year. It's not a lot, but like you're not going to get a 12-year-old to do that.
Yeah, but you'll get a 12-year-old. 12-year-old isn't going to buy one themselves. Their parents are going to buy it for them.
Will they?
Yes.
There's a... Okay.
It'll be one of your Christmas gifts. You'll get the system at Christmas, and you'll get your membership every year for $60 as well. You know, just put it on your Christmas list. It's something, because that's how kids do. That's how the demographics of 12-year-olds get their Xbox Live membership going.
That's a nice Christmas gift.
I know.
Man.
I know. Your kids are going to be so out of luck. Things. Right?
Right?
Yeah.
Closed. My wife thought it would be a brilliant idea this year to like, what did she say? It would be, I think it was 4 gifts, but I can only remember 3 of them. It was like 1 useful, 1 fun, 1 book. I'm sure there was a 4th one. I don't remember. But it was some sort of clothing. That's right. I skipped that one. I think she did too. I think about it. But so it's kind of like, which one would this fall under? Oh, useful.
So to answer your question, by the way, about specifically why I don't.
So what does online get you? Like you can play with friends?
Yeah.
Not local?
Yes.
Okay.
Be able to play online requires a membership. But it's like in order to find your friends, one of the things I can't find the quote, unfortunately, right now, but I read it somewhere. They're like, in order to like play with your friends, you'll have to use the voice controls.
What?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm like, oh my gosh.
How do they like, I don't just copy one of the other two, like code for code, deal with the copyright issues and do it right.
Unlike other things.
Pull Facebook, right? Yeah. Like, you know what? Xbox has really figured out the way to do online play and we're going to do it that way too.
Exactly. Unlike a lot of these other problems, this is a simple, elegant, solved problem.
Yeah, there's no need to reinvent this one and come up with a new name for it. Like, it's okay. Like, I'll put up the Joy-Cons, but figure this one out.
I know. Well, it's such a critical component to being able to play right nowadays because it's all about that social interaction. Like, Nintendo has continually pushed for their consoles the idea that the social interaction should be and continue to be sitting on the couch and playing next to each other. And obviously the Switch is putting a high priority on that. They want people to be able to sit in the same room and play together, which I appreciate. Like,
that's always been their thing.
And I think that is that's my biggest disappointment with PlayStation is there's so few options to sit with somebody and play together. And it's part of it is they want everybody to buy the system and have the, you know, and get a membership. But I'm like, what if I want to play with my roommate? Do we both have to buy? Why do we both have to buy a PlayStation to be able to play Battlefield together? It's ridiculous.
And, really?
Well, yeah, because there's not. I don't know about
it. It's not like a 2-player split screen option.
No.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's weird.
It is weird. Well, it's not weird. It's financially, you know, gratifying.
That's so weird.
Yeah, well. So
what about like sports games? They've got to have split screen.
I actually haven't.
I mean, that'd be
dumb. I'm pretty sure you can do that. You can play.
But how many controller slots are there? There's only 2, right?
There's no controller slots. It's all wireless.
Oh, wireless. What?
Yeah, man.
These guys.
It's the future.
These guys.
So.
Oh my gosh, how old school am I?
I know.
Controller slot.
Yeah.
Ah, oh, jeez.
Yeah. You doing all right there, over old timer? Yeah.
Oh, man.
It's interesting.
Dude, I was showing some kids. I don't know if I told you this. We had some kids over at our house. Let's see here. I want to say like maybe 5th grade, probably 4th grade and 2nd grade in that age range. And I had my old Nintendo, and I was like, have you guys ever seen this? Like, no, what's that? I'm like, yes, this is going to be awesome. And I was like, and then I pulled out my power pad, and I was like, have you guys ever seen this? I'm like, no, what's that? I'm like, I'm going to blow your minds. And I did. They were a sweaty mess. Half hour into it, and it was awesome. Did the one where, like, they got to go against the different runners, and the speeds get faster and faster.
Yeah, jeez.
And they were just like, they were winded at the end of it. And I was like, this is great. Like, how have you ever beaten it? I'm like, honestly, no.
Yeah, nobody ever has.
It's super hard.
You're running against a robot.
That's the one thing about all Nintendo games is, like, a lot of them, they just didn't get the whole, like, slowly ratchet up your skill level. Yeah. It was like easy or stupid hard.
Yeah.
I got this football game that I played again. I barely won. I had to take it into overtime to win it. And it was one where I couldn't stop him, save my life.
Yeah,
we just kept trading off touchdowns. Like, offensive, no problem. I ran the same play over and over until my player got hurt or tired. I flipped him out, did another one. Easy. I didn't stop a single play.
I remember that game.
Got it for our dad.
Yeah.
That was a classic. Dad, I got this football game for you on NES. I know you never play it, but I think you'd like it.
I know.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah,
exactly. My kids are totally going to do that to me. It's going to be annoying.
Oh, yeah.
And then you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go, oh, yeah, watch this.
Yeah. Well, you remember, you left for college, you brought the Nintendo. You bought the Nintendo 64, and I bought the first two games.
Yes, and I remember that.
I either got a bunch of the games as Christmas presents or bought them myself.
It's like N64 or Star Fox or something.
We had like 20 games, and I technically owned like 15 of them. And you were like, okay, you can keep your games. I'm keeping the N64 when you went to college.
Best negotiator ever.
And so, yeah, I was just like, that is so messed up. So I went and got the GameCube. And then for your graduation present, I bought you like, and by I mean our mom gave me the money, but I bought you like 3 GameCube games.
That's awesome. Yeah. NFL Blitz is one of them. That game's the best.
You can keep it if you want. I don't know how you'll play it. But
touche.
Yeah, it's good times.
Siblings and game consoles.
Say buying other people's video games is it's a classic.
So what do you think? Do you think they got a winner on their hands here? Like let's prognosticate a little bit here. What do you like? Do you think like $300, $400 if you want to actually play on your TV? Do you think they got something here? They're literally launching with, I think technically it's 5 games.
Yeah,
is technically how many they're launching with 20 or so more like actually specified later in the year, and then 80 vaporware.
Yeah,
out there.
Which,
by the way, in comparison, months before Sony had done theirs, they had announced 140 games before their console came out. So to kind of put it in, which you get the right game. Who cares?
Right.
Right. I feel like Xbox at one point in time could have said, we have one game that we're launching with. It's called Halo.
Yeah.
And they would have sold a bazillion copies.
Yeah. It's a couple of system sellers and then a pretty healthy ecosystem is.
Which obviously Zelda is a system seller.
Yeah. That's Mario obvious. Is. And
Mario, which they both look fantastic.
So
it's another Mario 64, essentially, is what I'm gathering from it, which that game's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm in.
I think what we're going to see is...
Oh, I love that game. I need to play it again.
I think what we're going to see is there is pent-up demand, I think, for a solid Nintendo system. I think people are excited about that and anticipating that they want that. And so I think that there is definitely potential for... making some, you know, for them making some pretty good sales. Additionally, the fact that it's like, as long as they don't launch another like handheld competitor, like as long as they really focus on this, the handheld market, if the handheld market moves to, if their entire handheld market moves to the Switch and the pent up demand for a Wii replacement moves to the Switch, they got some legs there to do some good business. I think that in the battery life interest problem is an interesting one to me, because
how long does a DS last for?
I've hours to tons of hours. Like,
okay,
if you put it into low power mode and get onto a plane, a 12-hour flight, by the time I land, I might be down to a third of the battery life.
Whoa.
Yeah, I mean, they last a long time. And now, if I'm doing 3D, full brightness, full sound and everything, it's like 6 hours. It's not, but it's still, you know, it's... But it's,
so they might have something similar.
I'm hoping that that's the case, and you just would never take it out of low power mode. But yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting. There's a potential problem there for it. But honestly, I don't think people care that much about graphics. Like, I get the idea that it's underwhelming compared to the PlayStation and the Xbox, but I don't think they were gonna ever. Dude, they were ever going to win there. Nintendo always wins by creating something that's fun to play in ways that other systems don't allow you to. The fact that you can take your Nintendo with you is huge. It's a big thing. And it's like PlayStation has tried to solve that problem in different ways, but yeah, they've never really done a good job. It was a big deal
when you brought your PlayStation up to my place to try the VR, and you were just like, oh my gosh, this is ridiculous. I never want to move it again.
Yeah.
Whereas this is like, pop it out.
Yeah.
Let's go take a vacation, kids.
And that's,
you know, that's kind of cool.
That's powerful. That's really powerful. And I think that there is definitely interest, especially in the larger market, for casual gaming on a TV. Low, you know, fun games that are easy to digest and don't have super great graphics demands. Like, there's definitely demand here. My prediction is Nintendo is going to sell quite well. They're not going to beat the PlayStation. PlayStation's still going to outsell them. But
You think they'll give Xbox a run for their money, huh? With their new, what do they call it? The Spectre or Spectral?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Well, I read a really interesting article this week where they, at the annual Game Developers Conference this week, they ran some polls and they asked the game developers about a bunch of different questions. And one of the big takeaways for the PlayStation Pro and the Xbox Scorpio, which are both, they're basically the 4K versions of their consoles. The developers were very neutral on it. There's not a lot of excitement. Very few developers are really developing for it. PlayStation Pro is selling very well, but it's not like it's,
well, that's for VR, not for 4K.
Well, yeah, that's part of it, and I just think that, I don't know, it'll be really, I think you're going to see Nintendo sell really, really well by Nintendo standards for the last couple of years.
Yeah, and
that's what the message is all going to be about, is that it's like, oh, Nintendo's really back, you know, they're just doing their thing. And they're such a weird company, because they almost feel like they're not competing against Sony and Xbox, especially because it is a mobile first device, really and truly. And there really isn't any other mobile first gaming consoles out there, you know, other than,
it's a different demographic.
Yeah.
I feel like I could talk Jesse into a Nintendo. I feel like I would struggle with an Xbox or PlayStation.
Yeah.
I know I would, because I've tried.
Which is weird, because the PlayStation and the Xbox are as much multimedia devices as they are game consoles nowadays, whereas the Nintendo is a game console. That's like all...
It's also true.
And I don't know. I think you're going to hear a lot of the... an end to the slide that Nintendo's currently in. I think this will be a very successful console for them from that perspective. I don't think it's going to be like... I don't think it's going to be Wii era success, though, where it was just like devastated.
Yeah, which we all knew that. And it was like, dude, enjoy this ride, because you can't do that twice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there's potential there. I think it's very good news for Nintendo. I think they did a good job of sort of coming out with that next stage of the company and becoming a mobile company. That's it. They don't make consoles anymore. They don't make living room consoles.
Yeah.
Which really, and truly, if you judge them by sales, they haven't made a living room console for a long time.
Oh, that Wii U is so bad.
Well, and what's really interesting is that, honestly, the Wii U is bad, but if you look at the Wii, its sales stalled long before the Wii U's came out. It wasn't you know, there was this unbelievable demand for the Wii for many, 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 many months. And then all of a sudden they topped out, and they topped out after like a year or two, and they just stagnated. They never really recaptured that.
Well, they hit that Christmas cycle, and everyone who wanted one got one. And then it was almost like they were working on the Switch and it wasn't ready yet. And so they went, well, let's do a spec boost on the Wii U.
Right.
On the Wii. We'll call it a Wii U. We all know it and we'll survive.
Right. And they, and where is the DS's, the handheld stuff? Those have a much more traditional lifespan in the gaming console, where there's good demand when it first comes out, but there's continual demand and a growing base over time. They have, you know, they expect them to have 5 to 6 year like lifespans. Like there's just this,
it's like you hit
growth.
It comes back to that demographic. It's like every year you hit a new generation of kids who are now of that gaming, and they want some sort of portable game, and parents go, well, what's out there? Oh, yeah. Yes. Sweet.
Yeah. I don't want to buy them an iPhone yet, but there's a deal. Well, and it's amazing how many of my friends that my age that are, you know, late 20s, early 30s, that's been the Nintendo of choice for kids my age for the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. But I would imagine. Yeah. But again, it's the idea of sales being consistent has to do with.
Well, and I guess I hear what you're saying, but my point is that, part of that, like, you know, a lot of my friends buy a console once a year, you know, and there's enough different stuff out there that it's like you buy Xbox 1 year, you buy the PlayStation the next year, you do the Nintendo the next year. And by the time you get around to the fourth year, somebody's come out with a new console, and there's like, and there's just sort of this, or maybe it's every year and a half, but it's like, but there's just this continual purchasing of devices. And a lot of these guys, instead of buying another Wii, you know, obviously, or instead of buying the Wii U, they were buying DSs. Now, if they're going to be buying the Switch instead, you know, you're going to see a much more stable product cycle for Nintendo, which will be very, very good. And I think their investors will reward them for that, you know, and, you know, having third parties developers come into and having such a focus on that is going to be really helpful for the company as well. You know, I think a big piece of this puzzle though is really going to be to see how well they execute on online play. You know, if it continues to just be terrible, if it doesn't just work, it's, you know, that could be bad.
Yeah.
But
okay. March 3rd?
March 3rd.
Okay. I'm not in a place where I can buy it out the gate, but I'll think about it.
I saw something else that cost the same that I'm going to buy before.
I'm still working on a bathroom and I have a whole list of other projects that I want to do the year. So,
see, what I really want is the Monoprice 13860 Maker Select 3D Printer V2. It's an 8x8x7 inch print space with a heated desk, and that's uses nice. The same software that I was using with the one that I borrowed. So this is like right in the bell horn of the type of device that I use then and want. And it costs $330 on Prime. I can literally have it by Tuesday if I order it within 19 hours and 36 minutes. But it's the cost of a Wii, or a Switch. So I'm going to get that instead.
I get that.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Pretty stoked. So
if I send you 3D files, you could print them for me.
I can. I'll mail you them back. And I charge very reasonable prices.
Good to know. I think HP might charge a cheaper price. But
yeah, well. Well, then go get it from HP, James.
Blah, blah, blah. Well, we'll see what they offer. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, speaking of future devices and the future of things, I want to switch conversations over to drones for a little bit.
Flying computers. So,
flying computers. The New York Times wrote a fun little article that essentially was titled "Santa Delivered the Drone, but Not the Safety and Skill to Fly Them." And the entire article, it's got a bunch of different tweets to go with it. And it says, this very first one from @MissJordan says, "My dad got a drone for Christmas. My dad lost a drone for Christmas."
That's rough.
And the next one says, my brother got a drone this morning and he flew it at a park and the wind carried it off and he lost it. Merry Christmas.
Oh, jeez. That would be so sad.
And then I like this one. Someday I imagine my son will think about this day, the day on which I lost his brand new drone somewhere in a tree, and laugh.
Oh, man.
And this one, a holiday story. Give nephew drone. Nephew flies drone for like 5 seconds. Drone falls, breaks. Christmas ruined. Drones are stupid. The end.
It's part of the problem is it's like really, really drones that don't just fall out of the air and are fragile are very expensive. Like it's a DJI. It's $1,000 drone. Like they're not there. And those aren't toys that you give a kid for Christmas. Like that's the complicated part.
Well, and they're saying most of these are the $100 ones that you buy at a discount retailer.
Yeah.
Or the $50 ones at Walmart or whatever. And that's when they're just like, yeah, they're super hard to control, to be honest. And they do get influenced by the wind super easily. They go, that is one of the nice parts about the DJI ones is at least when you get into that $1,000 range, like, yeah, they're harder to crash, but you still like, don't go 40 miles an hour day one.
Right. Yeah.
Start out with the 12.
It's
in an open space.
It's
learn how it works.
Yeah, that's the. I mean, it's they're not foolproof. that's
yeah, that's true. Yeah, because as we learned, you can back into a wall that doesn't have a camera for that. It won't let you go forward into one, but you can hit it on the side.
Right. I mean, the more modern ones actually do protect against that, but the last generation didn't. I mean, and that was like just last generation, that last year's model. Yeah, you could.
And those aren't the ones that people are buying.
Right. Those are $1,000 drones. They're expensive, you know?
Yeah. And, but it's just an interesting idea that there are people who are getting all these drones and it seems like a big thing, but a very like limited shelf life. It was like the drone that we got, what was that, 2 Christmases ago?
Yeah.
And yeah, it was fun to fly and did it a few times, and then after a while you're like, dude, this is stinking hard to control.
Yeah.
And the battery lasts just long enough to start to get your bearings and then dies on you. And you're like, well, all right, I guess I'll be back in 4 hours to try to learn again.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it was definitely it was funny too, because like there was a sweet spot right as it was starting to run out of batteries where it like became more stable.
Yeah, it actually slowed down just a little bit. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't quite as jittery anymore. I remember that. You know, like, all right, I'm actually getting it. Oh no, the battery's dying.
Yeah. That's a fun device. That was a fun Christmas gift, though, because it's just fun. It was fun to play with, and there wasn't this giant concern that you were going to go flying too crazy and break it. I don't know.
There were a few times, though. I think we recorded one of them where it was like we were near a tree, and it was like, I'm going near the tree. Get away. I don't know how. Yeah. I'm not touching anything.
Yeah.
But, it's a car that has a mind of its own.
That reminds me of that $100 or that 100-mile-per-hour drone that we were talking about last week, though. I mean, just... No, that is ferociously fast.
But again, that's one. You start at 10 miles an hour, and then you go to 20, and then you go to 50, and then you go to 75, and then you're at 100. And you're in an open desert area, you know?
Right.
And you're flying it at, you know, the hard deck is at 200 feet.
Right, yeah.
You know? and you know how to stop it. And I don't know. There's certain things where you do it smart, I guess, and their whole point is like, this is definitely not just a pick up and play type of thing.
Right.
There's some skill required, which I'm kind of like, you know what? Those are the things that will also take off if there's a little bit of skill required.
Honestly, that's actually a good thing for the market that they're not idiot proof. They don't fly themselves, you know?
Yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Give it time. Give it time. But,
so there was some other big announcement.
Yeah, so this is kind of cool. DJI acquired Hasselblad. Hasselblad? Hasselblad. Hasselblad.
Hasselblad,
I think. Whatever. Hasselblad is a camera company. They build pretty high-end, sophisticated cameras.
I was going to say, not just any camera company. That's like, get me high-end.
Right. Verge Ryder actually got to talk to some people behind the scenes a little bit and wrote an article where he described it as this as informed speculation. Consider what follows as informed speculation based on discussions with several sources familiar with the logic behind the deal. The best analogy for the marriage of DJI and Hasselblad is the acquisition in 2010 of the Swedish car maker Volvo by China's Geely Motors. At the time, Volvo was suffering from declining sales and lack of profits, hampered by its small-scale, high production costs and aging brand. Geely gave Volvo the financial support it needed to aim high. The company moved to create larger vehicles that would compete directly with the top German brands. 6 years later, Volvo sales and profits have reached all-time highs, paving the way for a potential IPO. Like Volvo, Hasselblad is headquartered in Gothenburg and found itself trapped in recent years by a vicious cycle of limited capital, short-term decisions. It made some small efforts to find its footing in the world of smartphones, but so far has not found much success. DJI, like Geely, believes the company can return to its former glory if given the breathing room once again to make bold long-term moves. What's really interesting about this is at this point, DJI builds their own cameras. It's a Sony sensor, but it's made in production. You know, Sony builds it to DJI specification.
Gotcha.
They're not Sony's not acting as a fabless manufacturer for DJI, but kind of. There's a lot of engineering that DJI is doing in their camera work, but now they actually own a camera company. DJI is making a lot of money. They have a tremendous amount of production skill at different scales. They're building really sophisticated electronics. They've got money. They've got talent to both design this type of device and to manufacture it. And so there's a lot of really good for Hasselblad. I think the interesting part about this is like, you know, what does this bring DJI other than the fact that, you know, money if Hasselblad takes off again. But I think the big thing here is that one of the markets that DJI doesn't own yet is full scale like production of movie production. The cameras, you know, the highest end cameras that you can get on the DJI drones are great, but they're normally used for B-roll or TV shows and stuff like that. You're not necessarily going to be doing your most sophisticated, important shots with a DJI drone. You're going to be doing backup stuff. And I think what they want to get into is the point where you can get a camera that can take blockbuster quality video and put it on a drone. And they also want to not have to have such a high reliance on companies like Sony to design their camera modules. And so I think for them,
well, it's becoming a core competency and you want those in-house.
Exactly. I think that's what you're seeing here is DJI has picked a brand that's got a lot of, that makes really high end stuff. And that's the reason why they want them.
They might've got it for a decent price, which made a lot of sense to them. Yeah. And
so, it's cool. It's exciting.
That is cool and exciting.
Yeah.
One company will not be heading down that track, and that would be Lily. We actually haven't talked about them on the podcast, but they were a drone company that they sold 34 million pre-orders.
No, $34 million dollars worth of pre-orders, remember?
Yes, correct. And they're announcing that they're shutting down.
Bummer. Yes. How many did they ship?
A couple.
Oh yeah.
They produced some prototypes and even started a beta program. That was it. They were scheduled to start in November shipping them, but were running. They literally didn't have the funds to produce them anymore. They somehow spent $34 million.
Oh, it's expensive.
And apparently, because one of the cool things about it was that it was going to be an autonomous camera drone, was the idea. And they first started it, I don't remember when, but at the time they were like the only ones doing AI assisted drone camera work.
Ooh.
And, so that was kind of like, everyone's like, that's super exciting. And since then other companies, most notably DJI, is now doing it. And so it's just one of those where the, they didn't foresee a way going forward. And so they're going to return money to all of the pre-order folks and shut down. But that, again, speaks to that idea. They took a risk and they thought they saw something. I think they were ultimately right. They just couldn't time it very well.
Artist ship.
Yes.
Man, this has been a good week for Steve Jobs, except for the whole being dead part. But
yeah, well, you know, yeah, so yeah, so they're done. So that's your drone update.
That's,
if you will,
man, oh man, oh man. Did you hear that? Once again, I don't have an article for this, but Parrot, fired 290 employees.
Oh
yeah. Parrot drone, because their sales didn't do very well during Christmas. So they are dealing with that.
Well, it's kind of like it's turning into, you get some Chinese knockoff discount drone or you get a DJI.
Yep.
Like that's the market.
Yeah.
Which sounds very much like a handset market.
Yeah, right? It's a good company. DJI is impressive.
Oh, man, I want a drone so bad. I think I would take a drone over a Switch. Is that... I think that's how it rolls.
You're such an adult. It's terrible.
I know. It's ridiculous.
I'm getting a 3D printer instead of a Switch, so I don't know how much better I am.
Yeah. I don't know where that goes.
So, yeah. So speaking of Chinese companies, Yahoo made an announcement this week. They are no longer going to be called Yahoo. They're going to be Altaba. And they,
Altaba.
And
I'm sure they like that comparison.
I would say they're getting rid of, what do you mean?
Oh, there's another alt group out there that is not looked upon super favorably by certain groups.
Okay. Yeah. Cause yeah, no, I mean the whole idea being that they're literally, the name is a combination of Alibaba and alternative. It's an alternative. Alibaba is how they came up with it. Really good, guys. Really good. So Yahoo, the company, is no longer going to be called Yahoo, the company. Marissa Mayer is stepping down, no longer the CEO of the company. And
usually happens when you get bought.
Yeah. And all of the Yahoo properties that are so toxic nowadays, Yahoo Mail, Yahoo Sports, their sports verticals, those are only keep those brands, but they're owned by Verizon now. So it's
just, you know, so weird.
Yeah. It's a Verizon company. They're Verizon Technologies and Properties. Wow. And yeah, so the holding, and the reason why the Yahoo is becoming Altaba is because really all that's left now is the enormous, like $34 billion worth of stock that they have in Alibaba. that massive investment that's paid off like crazy. So now that company is just a holding company for that enormous chunk of Alibaba. That's it. That's all she wrote. I missed.
Boom.
I'm pretty sure that means I would have been right in my predictions had it happened 16 days earlier.
Doesn't count.
I know.
This isn't horseshoes.
Super close.
Wow.
Super close. Yeah, that's it. That's end of an era. Which means that we are only a matter of time before the brand goes away completely. Because I think at this point the brand that is left is not worth as much as Verizon is paying for it.
Oh, totally.
And I think that Yahoo Mail becomes something else. I don't even know what, but it's like, I don't know.
V-mail. You got V-mail.
Why haven't they done that? That's not terrible.
I don't know.
Oh, Verizon.
Some random punk in some country owns the URL.
Probably, yeah. Oh, Verizon, you want V-mail?
I can
say, yeah. Look,
for a cool $500 million, it's yours.
I have a price. I'm willing to negotiate. I will come down 5%.
Dude, if I own an awesome URL like that, I'd probably be foolish and part for it for like $1 million.
Oh, is that foolish though? You know, cool mil?
Maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know. Depends on how quickly they say yes, I suppose.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Just because you could get more doesn't mean you're necessarily a person. I don't know.
See, I feel like at a million, you're not quite retired for life is the problem.
Yeah, but at the same time, all you did was buy a URL. You know, if they were buying your company or something that you... But all you've done here is camped on a particular string of letters. And I realize that that's worth a lot of money and from a negotiating perspective, but if somebody's willing to give you $1 million and that's all the more innovation you've brought to planet Earth is that you bought the URL first. I don't know. I feel like you can walk away with that feeling good about your character. I don't know. Maybe people are listening to me thinking this is why you'll never be a success. It's funny. There was a GIF on a reaction GIF on Reddit, and it was my reaction whenever somebody says, "I just want to play a game where everybody can have fun." And it was the scene from Troy where Achilles is saying, "And this is why no one will remember your name in history." I know. Oh man, good times. So this is
beautiful.
This is an interesting little turn of events. Yeah, it's been a bit of a video game week, but Microsoft announced this week that they are canceling an Xbox One exclusive called Scalebound, and the whole idea was like you're this like 20-something-year-old teenager with these cool headphones, and you're like going around and fighting and stuff, but you also have a dragon. And it looked really good. Everybody who played it said that it was really fun and, you know, had a lot of potential as a game, but it was still pretty deep in development. And it, sort of surprised everybody this week when they announced that it was being canceled. The studio that's actually building it basically said like, Scalebound was a heavy workload, according to insiders, and multiple senior developers were forced to take a few months off of working on the project. While they came back, that also meant that the game was even more behind schedule than before. When paired with existing missed deadlines and engine troubles, a cancellation was seemingly inevitable. There's no certainty that Platinum will revive the project under a new publisher or finish it alone. It had to show that it can get the technical issues under control and its development back on track. To no one's surprise, Microsoft is wiping most traces of the game mere hours from after the cancellation news, including official sites and trailers. The official site is also breaking the bad news to would-be players. So this is basically it sounds like they were having development issues and the whole thing kind of came undone, and instead of throwing good money after bad, they're pulling the plug. Just not going to launch the game. One of the things that I think is really interesting about it is that it's the game, the actual studio that was the group, the developers that were actually making it is Platinum Games, and they are still around. They're still making games, but instead of making an Xbox exclusive, they are going to be making a PlayStation 4 primary game first. That's what they're working on, and that will come out to Xbox later. And the reason why I wanted to bring this up is because at this point PlayStation hasn't outsold Xbox One 2-1, but it's closer to that than not. Wow. And there's even it is interesting to me that if a studio falls behind on a game that is already Microsoft was already doing marketing for it. They're already pushing it as an Xbox exclusive, but even that like tantalizing of a position on the table, given the choice between making a successful PlayStation game and a successful Xbox game, you're going to pick the PlayStation game. It's just pretty brutal. Sounds like there were some pretty deep technical issues behind the scenes, not just like game engine stuff, but promises of how you would play the game that were big technical problems. But just interesting to watch this, watch Sony continue to run away with it. And it's funny because it's like even I even come back to like the whole Project Scorpio. Xbox, Microsoft is really pushing the Project Scorpio thing. They want that to be a success.
Yeah.
That's like their next console. Sony launched the PlayStation Pro as sort of this afterthought of like, hey, you know, we know some of you are going to want to be able to do 4K. We know some developers want to develop 4K. So we're just going to put this out there if anybody wants it. And it's already like selling really, really well and way better than Sony anticipated, which is the same story that happened with the PlayStation 4. Like Sony was like, hey, we're building this good game system. These are our expectations for sales. And it's been way outselling it all along. And that Sony doesn't really know why.
Yeah, neither does Microsoft.
I know. And yeah, it's just pretty fascinating.
It's so weird how the network effect plays a role in all of this.
Yeah. And the further you get into these cycles, the more and more you run away with that network effect. Which is why I come back to, I think the creation of these, the idea that the end of the console like generations has arrived and they are now going to start developing these consoles like their cell phones, where especially Sony and Xbox, where every couple of years they come out with an updated system that's reverse compatible with the other systems. And then after three or four, you know, after a couple of those generations, the oldest
you drop support what? For the oldest. Yeah. You start dropping support
right.
for older versions.
And you'll do just what you do with the iPhone, and developers will just develop for wherever the most gamers are as time goes on, you know, but it allows you to maintain that large network of players who are already invested in the ecosystem and can play the game with you. Oh, so I think that's where we're going. There's another article that I read that was pretty interesting because there's a little bit of news and we talked about it briefly, but this idea that
I feel like I want to camp on that for just a little bit because that's a new concept. Because last cycle was a different cycle.
Yeah, completely different and consoles.
At least for Xbox, that's how they treated it.
Right.
And Sony was a little bit smarter about it, but still that wasn't their thought. And now it is very much, it's just a refresh.
Right.
I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, it's funny because it's like, you get a giant it's the online stuff that makes such a big difference, and it's so important to the, you know, how well these platforms deliver or perform. And one of the big problems that Sony because the Xbox was way outselling the PlayStation. PlayStation was selling better late in life, but the install base for the Xbox was way larger. And it was the network effect. People were buying it because their friends had it, and that's where all the attention was. And then the new platforms came out, and they completely did a hard break on the online environment. Like, you can't, if you have the Xbox One, you can't play with your friends who have an Xbox 360, even if you have the same games. Because their online worlds are completely different.
That was a huge mistake.
It was that was the most amazing part about it, was how Xbox had.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, Sony did the same thing, but they were coming from behind, so it wasn't viewed as it. And I think both companies watched what happened to Microsoft, where they are now way behind, and they both learned the same lesson, which is never do that again. And so the question kind of becomes, what makes a system different? what makes a new generation system? Well, it's upgraded processing power. It's better, you know, better graphics output. And it's, you know, I don't know, it was a new mobile, you know, like environment, a new operating system, a new programming paradigm. Like they can do all those things now in continuous development stuff. And there's just a paradigm that everybody's used to for given to us by the iPhone, where no, you just upgrade the operating system.
Treat it like a computer.
Yeah. Treat it like a computer. And unlike the Switch, which offers new functionality through inherently different hardware. But even Nintendo, it's funny, they've got their the DSs, that's what they've their handhelds all along have been this they all use the same cartridges, they're all reverse compatible. You just buy the newest one, and there might be a few games for that system, but most of the games are for older generations. For it, you buy the older generation games and you play it, and it's like that's the direction of all technology that everybody's been going in, and the cost of not doing that was super high to Microsoft. So they definitely don't want to do it. And Sony was like, well, we lucked out and won as a result of their mistake, but we don't ever want to make that mistake. You got to keep them, together. Hmm. So, interesting stuff.
There's a chance Microsoft can make a comeback if they can truly get another Halo type of game that pulls a community together.
Yeah.
And they could be back.
A real system seller.
Yeah.
Those are hard games to develop, James.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You don't just make.
I'm just saying, what I'm saying is it's not a lost cause for Microsoft.
Oh, no. And they're selling a ton of them. They're making a lot of money off of it. It's not like.
And I've got to imagine eventually they both hit some sort of. Critical mass where then it doesn't matter anymore because all your friends are on
right
both.
Yeah, I mean the question still becomes if your studio, you know, how much time does a studio, this is where the real dilemma happens. A studio wants to launch a game to as many users as possible. So they're going to ideally develop for the PlayStation, the Switch, and the Xbox. But they have a choice of how much, you know, and each platform is going to require its own separate development and specialization to get the graphics as good as possible for that system. And the Xbox and the Sony or in PlayStation are similar in their capabilities. So really and truly the difference in performance comes down to how much time does the developer spend developing for that particular platform and finessing it and working out all the small details. Well, they have limited time, so they're going to spend more time on the bigger platform. So the same games will come to both platforms. It's just that it'll look better on the PlayStation. It'll run faster. It'll run smoother because they have a bigger network. And that's what Microsoft is going to have to fight against and try to get around, and why these why exclusives are way more important for them than it is for PlayStation. But yeah, I'm actually going to skip this next article because we're running out of time, and the Apple one kind of fits into the theme of what the show has developed into. So Apple has they did make an update to the Apple TV, which for Christmas, I got the 32 gigabyte Apple TV, which I've been telling everybody, I'll just get the smaller one. You don't need the bigger one. Especially if you have a fast internet connection, which I do, because the largest app that you could put on your Apple TV was a 200 megabyte download, which is, you know, way, 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 three orders of magnitude smaller than the capacity of my Apple TV. So I was like, not that big of a deal. And then you would just on demand download content whenever it was needed for games. So if it was actually a 4 gigabyte game, the phone or the Apple TV wouldn't download the entire game. It would download chunks of games as it needed. Well, it turns out that's actually been kind of a stymieing the developers, and it adds a layer of difficulty that the developers don't want to invest in, unfortunately. And as a result, Apple has, it's slowed game development for the Apple TV. And so Apple has changed course this week, and they've now raised the limit to 4 gigabytes for games. So you are.
How many apps do you have on your Apple TV
right now? Like none. I got. Let's see here.
Yeah, I've got like Netflix, Pandora. I think I have a driving game and a fighter game, which the fighter game is really a demo, which I didn't know when I downloaded.
Do you have an Apple TV?
Yeah.
Where
have you been, man?
I don't know.
Yeah, dude, I want to be able to use Siri anywhere.
I don't think I knew that.
be able to enable triggers. That's why I have the monitor set. Oh my gosh. Anyways, my point being, like, I've literally downloaded, like, I guess I downloaded the Twitter one. Because that was, I don't know.
So I've got Digital Rain, which is just a Matrix screensaver.
Ooh, I have a fireplace one.
Oh, nice. I got to get that. I got Netflix, HBO Go, Cartoon Network, Trailers, Hulu, which I don't know why I have it because I don't use it, and YouTube.
I got YouTube.
I don't have any games. That's the funny part. I'm like, nah.
Well, and those apps don't take up any space.
Right. I gotta get.
The games are dumb. That's why I don't have any. I looked into it.
That might be the case. Kind of want Sonic the Hedgehog though. I'm so excited about Sonic Mania, whatever the game is called. The new Sonic that's coming out. That's right up my alley for the sort of thing that I'm excited about. I have bought Sonic the Hedgehog on basically every platform I've ever owned.
That's awesome.
I know. That's why I have to get it for the, I don't even have a choice, James. I don't care if it's good or useful or not. It's just, I can't have an Apple TV without Sonic the Hedgehog. As I don't have a PlayStation without Sonic the Hedgehog. I don't have a Nintendo without Sonic the Hedgehog. I don't have a mobile version of a Nintendo console. I don't have a console version of it. Like, I have Sonic on everything.
It's like maybe Top Gun.
Yeah, I've literally had the game right
here. What are you showing me right now?
This is Sonic the, it's Sonic Classic Collection for the Nintendo DS. I'm into it, man. I'm into it.
So you have to get a Switch so you can keep your Sonic.
No, see, that's not the thing. It's not that. You've missed the relationship here.
oh, causality. Which way is it going?
Exactly. But
they made a Sonic for it. I have to have the device, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Did I get that directionally right?
It's funny. I got it for my iPod.
Wow.
And I actually was pretty easy to play on the iPod because it's the controls are relatively simple.
Yeah, jump.
Exactly.
Pretty straightforward.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, that's my iPod Classic, to be clear, is what I was like with the click wheel.
Dang.
And the tiny
click wheel, the
tiny
up.
Little like impossible to see screen. It's good stuff, man.
I wanted to do I had an idea of like, I'd be like, it'd be pretty fun to do a montage of Luke Skywalker just saying impossible, but I'm pretty sure he only says like 3 times, but I'm like, it would still be good.
Yeah.
I was listening to someone today and he was talking about doing impossible things. I was like, oh, this would be a perfect clip. That's impossible. You want the impossible. It's like, man, what a whiner.
Yeah.
Anyways, last story of the day. Just want to let you know that the Sonos CEO is stepping down. Sonos makes the smart speaker systems that are wireless. They sound pretty awesome. They connect with a bunch of things. Essentially, what he's saying is he's tired and it's time to step down. And he also admits that he kind of missed the whole Alexa speak to me thing. When the Echo first came out, he did the dismissive, oh, that's cool, whatever, and did not spend the time investing in that space. And he was kind of like, oops.
That's well, and it doesn't help that the Wi-Fi consortium announced last week that they're going to replicate the function that that Sonos pioneered and became, and that the wireless syncing function you're going to be able to do with just standard Wi-Fi, which means every, like, any developer with a Wi-Fi antenna built into it, which you can buy, like, simple Wi-Fi connections for like $20. And I mean, it's one of those features that in a year or two will be replicated.
Well, it's super smart.
Yeah. Replicated and generalized. And instead of locking you into the Sonos ecosystem, it'll just work with everything. I think Sonos doesn't have a, this is a great time for the Sonos CEO to read the writing on the wall and think, yeah, I'm out.
Yeah, but yeah, so he's I guess he's 42 and he's done, and I'm assuming they're going to head in that direction because he's admitted it. But I don't know.
It's interesting that he's stepping down though. I honestly think there's either something going on that he's not talking about, or he's just reading the writing on the wall and realizes that Sonos.
He's going to remain an employee to help mentor colleagues and work on projects, but he's no longer CEO and he's no longer in the board.
Huh.
And he's actually saying, like, they weren't in a great place last year, but now they're up this year. So I was like, no, we're doing better than ever before. Now it's a great time for me to step down.
Yeah.
Oh, he said he had planned to resign earlier, but his wife had breast cancer.
Mm.
And his parents were getting older.
That I can see.
And so he delayed.
It's one of those things where, like, you've made an unbelievable. You've made so much money in your life that you never need to work again, and you'll only be working for fun. Why put yourself through the stress and agony of running a company if you got other priorities? Like, that, I can understand why somebody would come to that conclusion and say, "No, I'm happy to. I like working, but I just don't need the stress of being CEO." And there's other people that can do as good a job, and I'm really rich. So, bye.
Peace.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. But good company. I like what they make.
Yeah, definitely. They're good.
Their speakers are way too expensive for me, but whatever.
Mm.
he has this recognition. He's like, yeah, the Echo and Google Home and devices like that are now part of our competition, not just regular speakers. And they need to act like it, which is cool.
All right.
Sounds like a smart guy. That's what we got, dude.
I like it.
That's it. That's all she wrote. Well, everybody, thanks for joining us. We really do appreciate you listening to episode 277. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes with all the links at furloughbros.com. And you can sign up for our weekly summary of the show notes sent to you at the same site. And finally, we just want to thank all of our supporters of this podcast. If you would also like to become a supporter, you can contribute at 4 different levels. We've got tech fanboys, nerds, junkies, and mavens. And we'd love it if you joined us. Again, you can check all of this out at furloughbros.com to see how you can become a patron. So I am James Furlough, and my Latin America charging brother is Matthew Furlough. I already forgot what the Italian hello is. Somos puesto. What is it? I forgot. Matthew's taking an Italian class, so he was teaching me how to say I'm ready.
Sono pronto.
Sono pronto. That's right. Anyways, we will talk next time.